The final person I met with was Miss Kelly Goodwin, and to begin, she presented a patient from her practice.
So a 57-year-old gentleman, a finance professor, very active, who started to develop bilateral shoulder pain, and that prompted a visit to his PCP and plain films, which unfortunately showed a left upper lobe mass as well as some suspicious lesions in his scapula. And he was eventually found to have metastatic squamous cell lung cancer. That workup was all done at an outside institution. Then he came to us specifically interested in clinical trial options. And we had a trial for him, a randomized trial of carboplatin plus nab-paclitaxel. And then he could be randomized to either observation or nab-paclitaxel maintenance therapy.
So can you talk a little bit about how you all think through patients who have squamous cell cancer and metastatic compared to non-squamous cancer such as adenocarcinoma? What's sort of the typical path that they take both ways?
Yeah. So for your adenocarcinoma patients, we tend to pick pemetrexed as their first line of therapy, a platinum doublet including pemetrexed, and they may receive bevacizumab as well.
And that's with carboplatin?
With carboplatin typically is what we use, right, for our metastatic patients just because it's better tolerated than the cisplatin. So when we're trying to optimize quality of life, we pick carboplatin as our platinum backbone. So typically an adenocarcinoma patient, they're the patients who may have activating mutations. We see those less in squamous cell patients. But for the adenocarcinomas, they typically get carboplatin, pemetrexed, plus or minus bevacizumab. And for our squamous patients up front, that would be more carboplatin, paclitaxel, or nab-paclitaxel.
And what's the reason for the difference in choice of chemotherapy partner with the platinums, a taxane with squamous in your situation, and yet pemetrexed with adeno or non-squamous?
Yeah, so studies showed that the pemetrexed was beneficial in patients with the adenocarcinoma subtype and specifically not helpful in patients with squamous.
And when you have a patient who's about to get started on carboplatin, pemetrexed, and you mentioned bevacizumab, incidentally, how would you decide whether or not to use bevacizumab?
So bevacizumab, we make choices based on whether or not they've had a history of a heart attack or a stroke, if they're on anticoagulation, if they have brain mets, if those brain metastases have been previously treated or hemorrhagic, if they come to us with hemoptysis at the time of diagnosis, all of those are contraindications for using the bevacizumab.
And do most people end up getting bevacizumab with the carbopem? Or?
I would say the majority do not. Many folks who come to us have a recent history of a DVT or a PE. And unfortunately, a good proportion of our patients at the time of diagnosis have brain mets as well.
And in terms of the patients who end up getting on, let's say, carbopem and bevacizumab, what are some of the key patient education points you make when they start that therapy?
Sure. So for any general chemotherapy, we talk about how, unfortunately, it's not targeted directly at your cancer. It hits any cells that are rapidly dividing or still growing. So we hope that's more of the bad cells, your cancer cells, which are by definition abnormally growing cells. But we know that the chemotherapy is going to affect your good cells. That's where we get our side effects. Main side effects are fatigue, changes in your appetite, changes in your blood counts. So neutropenia, which increases your risk, obviously, of infection, and the importance of calling us if you were to get a fever or kind of focal symptoms of an infection, like a junky cough or lots of diarrhea or irritated voiding symptoms, problems with the lining of your gut. So dry mouth or changes in your taste, mouth sores, nausea, vomiting, changes in bowels, diarrhea or constipation, though I think in general we see more constipation when folks are more tired, not moving around much, when patients have a low appetite, aren't drinking as much, and some of our antiemetics are constipating as well. With the carboplatin, we do talk about the risk of hair loss or hair thinning. We do talk about risk of peripheral neuropathy, though we see it more frequently with cisplatin. We talk about problems with kidney function tests or electrolytes if your kidneys aren't so happy. So the importance of staying well hydrated and eating small, frequent meals. And we talk about the risk of an allergic reaction or hypersensitivity reaction, which is typically occurring in the infusion unit. So letting their nurse know if they were to have chest pressure or shortness of breath, wheezing, flushing, itching, hives, that sort of thing. With the pemetrexed, we talk about the need to start folic acid and to start vitamin B12 injections every 9 weeks. We talk about the risk over over time of some fluid retention in the ankles, or we talk about the risk of a rash and the necessity of taking some steroids around the time of chemotherapy to minimize that. Specifically to the patients getting bevacizumab, we talk about the risk of increased bleeding and the risk of poor wound healing. We ask them to give us a call, obviously, if they're having nosebleeds, blood in the urine, blood in the stool, dark stool, sudden onset of severe abdominal pain, because it's been associated in a rare number of patients, but a very significant problem of a perforated bowel. And we've actually had folks who have been hospitalized for that. So those, I would say, are our main teaching points for the carboplatin, the pemetrexed plus or minus bevacizumab.
And then on the other hand, when you have patients with squamous cell and even adeno who are going to be getting taxanes, you mentioned nab-paclitaxel, paclitaxel, also docetaxel. What are some of the key patient ed issues there?
So similar in terms of the changes in energy, appetite, changes in blood counts with the taxanes, we focus a little bit more on the neuropathy, so the numbness, tingling in the hands or feet, a little bit more on the fluid retention. The taxanes can also cause excessive tearing, which can be bothersome to patients. We don't have to focus on the steroids taking around chemotherapy for the rash or certain vitamins, but certainly more, I would say, more significant fatigue, changes in appetite, mucositis can be a little bit more significant. And I think with some of the taxanes, we end up seeing more diarrhea than constipation, so I may focus a little bit more on the loperamide instructions.
What was this man's sort of general physical condition and symptomatology at the point at which he started the treatment with the carboplatin with the nab-paclitaxel?
By the time he came to us, he had actually underwent upfront some palliative radiation to his bony metastases. So he came to us on long-acting opioids. He was still working full-time as a finance professor. He has two young children. He was still involved with their Boy Scouts. But he was fatigued. He was losing some weight. His mood was pretty low, knowing that he was going to be on the chronic opioids.
And what happened when he got started on treatment?
He actually did quite well. His energy improved. His stamina improved. He actually picked up a couple of extra classes. In terms of side effects from chemotherapy, like I said, his energy improved and his weight improved. His appetite actually improved as we got his cancer under control. He really didn't have any significant nausea or bowel changes. He didn't develop any neuropathy. He did run into some problems with his blood counts. With the carboplatin nab-paclitaxel, the carboplatin's given every 3 weeks. The nab-paclitaxel's given weekly. So frequently he would come in, he would receive his day one therapy of the carboplatin plus the nab-paclitaxel. He would come in the following week for his day eight of nab-paclitaxel. And then his day 15 nab-paclitaxel was frequently held for low neutrophils or platelets.
I'm kind of curious in general what your experience is with nab-paclitaxel and whether you think it's any different than paclitaxel. I guess a couple of things that are sort of different is the infusion's shorter and you don't need corticosteroid pre-medications.
Correct. I would say, in general, we give more paclitaxel as opposed to nab-paclitaxel, and it's probably location alone. You know, we're a large academic medical center in the heart of the city. It's difficult for patients to come in weekly to see us. So I think frequently we give the docetaxel so that the therapy is still every 3 weeks. But the nab-paclitaxel we certainly use for folks who have problems with their blood sugar, so poorly controlled diabetics, because of the benefit of not having to give the steroids.
And other than that, anything else that you can tell in terms of the difference? Do you think there's any difference in the neuropathy that you see?
I think with my patients personally, the neuropathy has been better with nab-paclitaxel. I think that they run into more issues with their blood counts, but I think that the neuropathy has been better, and I think overall the therapy has probably been better tolerated in terms of fatigue or GI toxicity when you're breaking up the dose instead of giving them a sort of whopping dose every 3 weeks.
So he gets the carbo nab and then nab maintenance. And how long was he on that total therapy?
Correct. So he received the doublet therapy for 4 cycles and had a smashing response, greater than 40% reduction in his tumor burden. And then after 4 cycles of the carboplatin nab-paclitaxel, he started his maintenance nab-paclitaxel. His initial restaging after 2 scans showed stable disease. And then after an additional 2 cycles of therapy, he started to progress. Over this time, because of the recurrent issues with neutropenia, some of his treatments had been delayed or held, and we had had to reduce his dose twice. But after his fourth cycle of maintenance therapy, he started to progress with a new left hip met that was symptomatic, some new subcutaneous metastases on his back and on his chest, and minimal progression in his adenopathy.
So it's interesting nowadays, and I'm not sure exactly how long ago was it that he had the progression?
About August of 2016.
Right. So I guess nowadays, typically the second line therapy for a patient with squamous or non-squamous, and some people maybe even the first line, is going to be a checkpoint inhibitor. And I see that he went on a clinical trial.
He did.
What was the trial he went on?
He went on the Master Squamous Study run by the SWOG group.
Right, the big study that
correct.
Where they look at the tissue and then decide if there's anything that they could target.
Right, and he was randomized to the nivolumab arm.
So he must, yeah, I know they look for in the tumor. As you mentioned, squamous doesn't really have these activating mutations that you can treat, but this study that he was on, they're trying to see whether they might have some.
Correct.
But for the people who don't have targetable mutations who go in the study, they get the checkpoint inhibitor, mm-hmm. which is probably what he would have gotten anyhow.
Anyway.
So he gets nivolumab, the anti-PD-1 agent. What happened then?
He's doing fantastic. So his hip pain, at the point of progression when he was having so much hip pain and he was having some difficulty with weight bearing and mobility, he did take a break from systemic therapy and he got palliative radiation to the hip. And then he started the nivolumab. And within the first cycle of nivolumab, clinically it was nice. We could see regression of the subcutaneous metastases,
wow.
right? In general, we don't have a sense of how people's cancer is behaving or responding to therapy until we do restaging scans, you know, 8 to 12 weeks later, but they were shrinking like hotcakes.
Could he feel these subcutaneous lesions decreasing?
He could, and we saw him every other week on therapy, and they were barely palpable
wow.
by the four-week mark.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
And did he have any side effects or tolerability issues with the nivolumab?
He has had a little bit of fatigue from the nivolumab. I think in general, our patients tolerate the immunotherapy really well. He notes some fatigue for up to 4 days or so after therapy, but he now has normal blood counts, so no issues with blood counts. He hasn't had any issues with his sugars, with his liver function, any issues with his breathing. He has essentially, other than the fatigue, had a wonderful response to therapy and an improvement in his quality of life.
And how long has it been that he's been on the nivolumab?
He's just started cycle 7 last week.
What a story. So, and I guess, I mean, it's great that he had this response, but maybe not every patient has that. In fact, probably most patients don't have that. In fact, most patients have disease progression. But I guess the thing that's been fascinating about the checkpoint inhibitors is that when you see patients like this, a lot of times they have prolonged responses.
Yes, so that's the benefit, and that's what we tell folks. People see the commercials for it nowadays and always ask for it anyway, and we say, yes, the standard of care is when you progress on your first-line platinum doublet therapy that you will receive immunotherapy. It is not a home run. In fact, the response rate is fairly equivalent to our standard second-line chemotherapy, which had always been docetaxel, but the length of response and overall response, the improvement in life expectancy is certainly better. But again, it's roughly 20% or so of patients who are going to respond to therapy. So I think it's important when patients are at a transition point in their treatment that you remain hopeful, but you try and set realistic expectations that this isn't a home run.
How do you explain to patients, how did you explain to him how these checkpoint inhibitors actually work?
So he tolerated his chemotherapy really well, except for the blood counts, I would say, but in folks who had standard chemotherapy and experienced the kind of typical side effects of some nausea and fatigue, I can say that the immunotherapy is typically better tolerated, right? So chemotherapy, like I'd said earlier, is not targeted directly at your cancer. It's rapidly dividing cells. The immunotherapy works by revving up your immune system. And so the side effects are completely different. We don't tend to have issues with blood counts or with nausea or vomiting. Immunotherapy side effects are rare, but they come when we overactivate the immune system. So I say, you know, in general, think about when you cut yourself and your body sends your immune cells to the area to repair the injury. Cancer is smart and was able to hide itself from your immune system. So your cancer was able to grow unchecked. That's why your body didn't recognize this cancer and destroy the cancer. This is sort of how we got to this place. The benefit to these immune therapies is that they're able to kind of unmask the cancer from your immune system, rev up your immune system so your body can fight the cancer.
So, as you mentioned, one of the issues here, though, is the effect on the immune system as it relates to side effects or toxicities. What are some of the kinds of problems that you see? I don't know if you've actually seen any. And what do you bring up to patients?
Yeah, we've treated a lot of folks on immunotherapy through clinical trials, and now since nivolumab has been approved since March of 2015. So we've seen a lot of actually the rare side effects. I say the side effects are rare, but it can essentially cause inflammation of any of your good tissues. So sometimes that is inflammation of the thyroid, which can make you feel more tired, can lead to cold sensitivity, can lead to mental status changes or constipation. It can certainly cause pneumonitis, so inflammation of the lungs, right? So a lot of our folks already have shortness of breath or a cough or wheezing related to their cancer, but I need you to call me. If you have kind of an acute change in your breathing, you're feeling more short of breath, you have a more significant dry cough, if you notice a lot more wheezing, it can cause hepatitis, so inflammation of the liver, which often you won't feel, but we monitor your blood work every 2 weeks. But if you were to notice lots of nausea or vomiting, right upper abdominal pain, I would want you to give me a call. It can cause nephritis, so inflammation of the kidneys. Again, you won't feel that so much, but we might notice that in your blood work, or you may notice dark urine. It can cause a rash or just generalized dry itch or generalized dry skin or itching. It can cause colitis. So if you have, unfortunately, lots of diarrhea, bloody diarrhea, lots of mucus in the diarrhea, you need to give us a call as well. And it can also cause pancreatitis. It can cause issues with hyperglycemia. And I've actually seen all of them.
I've heard people say if it ends in itis, you can see it.
You can see it.
What about, did you mention pneumonitis?
Pneumonitis, yep, yep. So I specifically was talking about changes in their breathing or their cough. They come to us baseline, you know, with symptoms related to their lung cancer, but changes, so a more dry cough, more wheezing, more shortness of breath are concerning to us for some pneumonitis.
And I don't know if you've had any patients in this situation, but it always seemed like it'd be very provocative where they have metastatic disease and you're thinking about a checkpoint inhibitor, but they have a history of an autoimmune disease, like Crohn's disease, for example. Have you had any patients like that, and what do you do?
Yeah, so we actually had a patient with really bad psoriatic arthritis come to us, and he was in a tough spot in terms of his cancer. Given his performance status, he wasn't really a candidate for a lot of cytotoxic chemotherapy, and he really wanted to try and give immunotherapy a shot. He was at baseline on low-dose prednisone through his rheumatologist, and we did start the immunotherapy. Unfortunately, he had a flare of his arthritis. He had significant joint pain after a single dose.
Wow.
Yeah, we were able to go up in conjunction with his rheumatologist, we were able to go up on his steroids for a short period of time, get that back under control, taper him back down to about 5 milligrams of prednisone a day, and retry the immunotherapy. And he has actually done quite well symptomatically since then.
Wow.
So it's not, you know, we tell them it's not a complete contraindication, but certainly we're worried. We're going to keep a close eye on you. We have to weigh the risks and the benefits.
That's an amazing story. But, you know, the thing that's so provocative about this is you can say, well, okay, well, we really don't know, and you know, there's a risk, but you're looking at a very dismal prognosis otherwise. So it's a very challenging clinical situation. That case is really fascinating. What fraction of patients get checkpoint inhibitors who just sort of cruise right through it?
I would say the majority of patients cruise right through it. When I'm doing my therapy, I say that the risk of those immune-mediated side effects is pretty small, much less than 10%. We see it, I think, frequently just because of the size of our institution and the number of clinical trials that we've had. We've had those drugs around for a number of years, but the vast majority of patients cruise right through it. And unfortunately, the patients who feel poorly when they're receiving the immunotherapy are usually the patients who just aren't responding. So on their first restaging, unfortunately, we see disease progression.
There is a lot of stuff to think about in terms of this, but you know, it's interesting, some of the trials that have randomized people between chemotherapy, like I mentioned, there was one study of a checkpoint inhibitor against docetaxel. And then you look at the side effects and quality of life in the docetaxel arm, you know, it's not very good. You sort of forget that chemotherapy is really, it seems like it's a lot more difficult than checkpoint inhibitors.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that has completely changed how we talk to patients, right? So when the drug first came out, patients would get their platinum doublet, and at the time of progression, they would get docetaxel. And then if patients were feeling poorly and had a kind of poor performance status because they had progressed on the docetaxel, you could say, go ahead and give them immunotherapy. It's well tolerated. Whereas if we didn't have immunotherapy, that might be when you initiate your hospice talk and talking to patients about kind of the risks of additional chemotherapy outweighing the benefit, and sometimes chemotherapy causing significant side effects and reducing your life expectancy. So we used to be able to do doublet docetaxel immunotherapy. And now that the data has come out and immunotherapy has kind of replaced docetaxel as the standard second line therapy, when folks progress on immunotherapy, they don't often then get a third line of therapy because their performance status is not good enough to receive something like docetaxel.
Also, it brings up the fact that while the checkpoint inhibitors came in as second line therapy, now we're starting to see some information using checkpoint inhibitors up front, particularly in patients, or specifically in patients who have elevated levels of PD-L1 in their tissue. I mean, these data only came out a few months ago. Are you starting to use these agents first line outside of a trial setting?
Yes, absolutely. Yep, we're using pembrolizumab up front in patients who have a greater than 50% positivity.
A couple other things I want to ask you about related to this case. Now, this man had metastatic squamous cell cancer. And one therapy that's been talked a lot about and actually became approved is an anti-EGFR antibody, necitumumab, added onto chemotherapy. I'm curious because there's been a lot of debate about that because the benefit's not that great. But on the other hand, particularly in a younger patient like this, you know, you want every possible benefit. What you and your team are thinking and doing about this agent?
I have to say we haven't used it. I'm not aware we've used it yet. I'm one of 6 nurse practitioners, and we have 11 attendings, and I'm not aware that any of our attendings have used it.
Any thinking in terms of why you're not using it?
I don't know yet. I haven't explored that with them. I'm not sure if it's because of it's just not a home run in terms
right.
of the response, or if they're worried about side effects. But given that it hasn't been, I think, a home run, and we just have access to so many clinical trials, often patients get sort of funneled to clinical trials instead of drugs that weren't so exciting.
We'll go through all your cases. We've gotten into a bunch of these other issues. Checkpoint inhibitors we got into with this man, the adjuvant chemo we did before. I wanted to ask you a little bit about ALK disease. But one more thing I wanted to ask you about with this patient is you mentioned that he had minor children. How old were they?
At the time of diagnosis, they were 11 and 13.
And I'm curious what you thought about, what he talked about, whether you know anything, and what your experience is with patients who have incurable cancers with minor children.
So often at the time of diagnosis, that's one of their greatest concerns, how they're going to explain their disease to their children, sort of how they're going to explain how this happened to me and what the next months or year or longer might look like in terms of me going to the doctor, receiving treatment, what side effects I might experience and how that might change our home life and our normal routine if I'm not feeling well, how they explain sort of mortality to their children and planning for the future, how they make the most of the days where they feel well. And how they can kind of build their legacy to leave behind for their children. So talking about parenting at this time is really difficult. And again, we have the benefit of a wonderful palliative care group who often gets involved with our young patients to help with coping and kind of legacy building. And we also have a team of psychologists and therapists in a group called the Parenting at a Challenging Time, or PACT group. And we can often refer them. And they have lots of resources in teaching our patients how to communicate with their children, how to alleviate some of the fears. And we often have patients bring their young children into the clinic. You know, they're seeing us once a week or, you know, a couple times a month. And so their children will come in for the visits and sort of get used to the team, sometimes go up to the infusion unit with them. And I think that that takes away some of the anxiety.
What about with this man? Did you have any discussions with him? Did he mention them?
His children have come in before. They've never come into the clinic. They've stayed in the waiting room, or his wife has taken them sort of shopping and around the city while my patient's been treated. His children are, it sounds like, I haven't met them, but very well adjusted. They understand his disease, but they see that he has tolerated the treatment well overall and that he has responded to the treatment well overall. His restaging scans on the nivolumab have actually also shown a partial response. He's had a greater than 40% reduction in his tumor burden. So I think maybe he hasn't had to have some of the harder discussions with his children that some of our other patients have had, because he's really done better than the norm.
Any sort of personal reflections on this issue?
I met with a patient yesterday and I had to give her bad news last week. She's an older woman. She's about 70 years old. She has children my age and she has small grandchildren. And it's terrible to give good people bad news, right? Or it's terrible to give bad people bad news. It gives you a lot of perspective. And her husband has a very difficult time coping. He's a pharmacist, so he understands some disease processes and medical terminology, but not a lot of the decision-making in our practice. And he has lots of questions about why we can't do this, that, or the other thing. And as I'm delivering this bad news, he kept interrupting me and, you know, holding my hand. And I became a mother this year, so I have an 8-month-old. And he just kept telling me to go home and hug my child, to go home and hug my husband, and to never take a day for granted. And my team calls it pulling a Kelly because I often cry before my patients. So I think I have a good perspective about sort of the bigger things in life and what's important because of what I do. But sometimes I certainly cry with my patients and certainly around patients' fears about leaving their children behind. I think it's the most important part of my job, I think, is identifying with the patients. I think I had told you before when we were at the ONS conference that my father had lung cancer when I was younger.
Well, that's why I brought it up. Yeah. I remember that.
Yeah. He was a police officer. He was a big, strong guy. And he was a former smoker, but he had quit about 20 years before his diagnosis. And I think he had a lot of guilt about developing lung cancer and sort of leaving us behind. And did he do this to himself? And he passed away within 2 years. He was originally diagnosed with what we thought was curable disease, and he metastasized very quickly after his initial therapy. He passed away within 2 years. And I always said that I wanted to work in oncology, but I could never do lung cancer because it was a little too close to home. And then I fell into this job with my group, and I couldn't be happier. And I think it gives me a great perspective.
How do you think, I mean, it's a big question, but how did that experience affect you? How old were you at that point?
I was 20 when he passed away. I was a sophomore in college when he was diagnosed, to the beginning of my sophomore year, and he passed away sort of in my junior year, so less than 2 years.
Just want to sort of backtrack a little bit and ask you about ALK inhibitors, mm-hmm. what your experience is, again, in terms of tolerability. Right now, it seems like the two that are kind of out there that are used the most is crizotinib, alectinib, there's also ceritinib out there. What's your experience with these agents?
So I think when patients are first diagnosed with metastatic lung cancer with an ALK mutation, we typically put them on crizotinib. Alectinib is great for patients with CNS disease. It has better CNS penetration, but I still think the norm is to start our folks on crizotinib. And when I do the teaching session with these folks, it's a lot like my EGFR patients where I talk about that it's a specific mutation to their cancer, which turns their cancer on and not something that they inherited from their family or will pass on to their children. And the side effects for the ALK inhibitors are some changes in energy, some changes in appetite, sometimes some visual changes with crizotinib, so floating or trailing lights, difficulty with transitioning from a dark space to a light or vice versa. There's a rare risk of pneumonitis. Sometimes they can have elevation in their liver function tests. Crizotinib can cause esophagitis or nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, sometimes some lower extremity edema, even some upper extremity edema. I do have one patient who actually developed significant esophagitis related to her crizotinib. So I think you always have to be mindful of reminding patients that they have to take their crizotinib with a full glass of water and sit upright for at least an hour after dosing. I have to admit that I didn't always remember that teaching point. And until I had this patient develop really a significant esophagitis, so lots of painful belching, pain with swallowing, heartburn, nausea. She was referred to the GI group and was found to have a bad esophagitis and was put on high-dose omeprazole for about 12 weeks until it eventually improved. She went on to then get alectinib, and alectinib was much better tolerated. She didn't have the GI side effects. Folks on alectinib don't typically have diarrhea, don't typically have the visual disturbances, don't typically have issues with edema. Sometimes we still see elevation of their liver function tests, elevation in CK, and so some muscle aches and pains requiring sometimes a dose reduction. And the benefit to the alectinib is it has better CNS penetration. We don't use ceritinib all that much. I think ceritinib, unfortunately, has more GI side effects. We've certainly seen patients with more nausea and diarrhea on the ceritinib. And then we have the benefit, like I said, of having a lot of clinical trials at our disposal. And so we have a fair number of patients on lorlatinib as well, which I think is the next ALK inhibitor, also really well tolerated. Not as many GI side effects, obviously, as crizotinib. Some issues with edema we've seen with lorlatinib. We've certainly seen issues with increased appetite on that therapy and significant weight gain in some of our patients. And lorlatinib can also cause some mood changes.